content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 29th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A major setback in Iraq. What happened? Militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria seized the Iraqi city of Ramadi on Sunday in the most significant victory for the Islamist terror group since U.S.-led airstrikes began in the region last August. The Sunni extremists launched their assault on the capital of Anbar province, 70 miles west of Baghdad, under the cover of a sandstorm that left American warplanes unable to identify targets. They quickly overran Iraqi security forces, who fled in a chaotic retreat that left behind dozens of U.S.-supplied vehicles, including tanks, artillery pieces, and Humvees. About 500 government soldiers were killed, and their bodies, some burned by ISIS, littered city streets. At least 25,000 residents fled the city. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, a Shiite, immediately deployed thousands of Iranian-backed Shiite militias to retake the Sunni-dominated city, raising fears of further sectarian violence. Meanwhile, the U.S. stepped up airstrikes in the region. "This is a difficult, complex, bloody fight," said Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren. "There are going to be victories, and there are going to be setbacks." Before Ramadi fell, the U.S. had registered one victory by killing ISIS's finance chief last week in the first successful raid U.S. special forces have ever conducted inside Syria. Abu Sayyaf, a key commander who managed the group's lucrative oil and gas operations, died in a heavy firefight as he tried to avoid capture. The Delta Force commandos also took Sayyaf's wife alive for interrogation, rescued a young Yazidi woman who'd been taken as a slave, and removed a treasure trove of intelligence material. What the editorial said: the fall of Ramadi proves President Obama's half measures to defeat ISIS won't do the job, said the Washington Post. The war-averse commander-in-chief refuses to allow U.S. troops training Iraqi forces to join them in battle, and will not send special forces behind enemy lines to mark out targets for airstrikes. His reluctance to be dragged into another prolonged ground war is understandable, but Obama's minimalist policy is actually prolonging the conflict. It probably won't be long before Ramadi is retaken, said BloombergView.com. But if Shiite troops and militias do the bulk of the fighting and commit the atrocities they inflicted on Sunni residents when liberating Tikrit last month, it could mark the end of any hope for a unified Iraq. That'd leave Iran in de facto control of Baghdad and the Shiite South. U.S. ally Kurdistan isolated and vulnerable, and the Sunni region a potential safe haven for al-Qaeda. The U.S. should insist that well-trained Sunni brigades lead the fight against ISIS so the battle is waged in a way that helps to heal sectarian divisions. What the columnist said: face it, ISIS is winning, said Norman Rickleffs and Derek Harvey in the Wall Street Journal. Obama must adjust his strategy before conditions in Iraq deteriorate any further. He should drop his arbitrary 3,000-man cap on U.S. troops in the country, allow U.S. soldiers to embed with Iraqi units, and authorize more special forces raids on high-value targets. Like it or not, the U.S. is the only country with the strength and know-how to rid Iraq of ISIS. Sending in more U.S. ground troops would be foolish, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. This is a conflict rooted in decades of sectarian strife, involving half a dozen warring regional players. It won't be solved by a few thousand American ground troops, whose presence in Iraq would only help ISIS recruit more fighters. Besides, ISIS isn't that mighty. Only 400 of its fighters overran Ramadi. If Iraq can ever train a competent army with U.S. help, it could easily rid the region of this gnat-like pestilence. It appears that most Americans are willing to accept ultimate defeat in Iraq as they once did in Vietnam, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But the two conflicts are very different. While the post-withdrawal problems in Vietnam were largely contained to Southeast Asia, Iraq lies in the middle of one of the most strategic regions in the world, a crucible for radical Islam and terrorism. If we lose this war, we won't be able to put ISIS's nightmarish savagery in the rearview mirror. And a second main story, biker bloodshed in Texas. Authorities in Texas warned of further motorcycle gang violence this week after a turf brawl between bikers at a Waco restaurant escalated into a Wild West-like gunfight, leaving 9 people dead and 18 injured. Police believe the shootout erupted when members of the Cossacks biker gang showed up uninvited at a meeting being held by the Twin Peaks at the Twin Peaks restaurant by the rival Bandidos gang, and one biker ran over another biker's foot in the parking lot. A fist fight turned into a gun battle involving dozens of people. Police who were monitoring the meeting opened fire after being shot at. At least 170 bikers were charged with engaging in organized crime. Some may be charged with murder, and more than 1,000 weapons were recovered from the scene, including clubs, chains, and handguns. Police said the clash could result in revenge attacks among gang members. In the biker world, said Sergeant W. Patrick Swanton, violence usually condones more violence. This gun battle is a reminder that motorcycle gangs remain a force in the U.S., said Dan Frosch and Nathan Koppel in the Wall Street Journal. The Justice Department estimates that there are more than 300 outlaw motorcycle gangs in the country, with the Bandidos among the largest and fiercest. The gang has 900 members, many of them former veterans who struggle to fit back into society, and it has long trafficked in methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, and illegal guns. A Bandidos-Cossacks showdown has been brewing for years, said Tim Madigan in the Washington Post. For nearly 5 decades, the Bandidos monopolized the Texas Bottom Rocker, a jacket patch that asserts the gang's claim to the Lone Star State. But in 2013, the upstart Cossacks affixed the word Texas to the back of their jackets. In that shadowy world, it was an unforgivable provocation. Compare the reaction to this wild shootout to that toward the violence in Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri, said Dan Solomon in TexasMonthly.com. Why isn't anyone calling on white community leaders to denounce the bikers? Where are the condemnations of the bikers' parents for raising them to be thugs? If black gangs had caused a bloodbath and shot at cops, it would be perceived as an isolated incident involving only the people who drew their guns. It wouldn't be perceived that way. The controversy of the week, Amtrak. Did lack of funding cause a deadly crash? You get what you pay for, said Harold Jackson in the Philadelphia Inquirer. We still don't know exactly what caused an Amtrak train to derail last week outside Philadelphia, killing 8 passengers and injuring more than 200. But we got a powerful clue the next morning when, with bodies still trapped in the wreckage, the Republican-controlled House Appropriations Committee voted to slash another $260 million from Amtrak's already meager budget of $1.4 billion, just a fraction of what China, Japan, and European nations spend on their mass transit systems. "There can be no doubt that Congress caused the Amtrak crash," said Irwin Redliner in thedailybeast.com. "The train derailed because it was doing 106 miles per hour going into a curve rated at 50 miles per hour. Had the track been equipped with GPS-based positive train control, PTC technology, the system would have slowed the train automatically. The inexcusable lack of PTC on that section of track perfectly illustrates the dangerous short-sightedness of Congress's reluctance to invest in our outdated rail network." "The liberal ghouls rushing to score political points off this tragedy are ill-informed," said Scott McKay in Spectator.org. "The truth is that PTC was installed on the relevant section of track, but thanks to Amtrak's persistently incompetent leadership, it hadn't yet been activated. Since its founding in 1970, Amtrak has burned through $45 billion of taxpayer money, much of that in the inflated salaries of its unionized employees, who took home an average of $91,000 in 2010. The only sane solution is for Amtrak to be sold off and privatized," said Jeffrey Dorfman in Forbes.com. "Why should taxpayers keep subsidizing an inefficient, money-losing rail service that only somewhere around 1 or 2% of Americans actually use? Amtrak would attract more passengers if we invested to improve the service," said Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker. "The number of passengers in the Northeast Corridor has soared 50% to 11.6 million people a year over the past 15 years. Imagine how much demand there'd be for a truly modern rail service. Sadly, our country has an entire political party devoted to the idea that any money spent on public goods is money misplaced, particularly when it's spent on mass transit. Republicans hate Amtrak not just because its most popular routes link the liberal urban enclaves along the Northeast Corridor, but also because to them the very idea of citizens traveling together with a common view and a singular destination smacks of socialism. In the 1960s, says Rex Nutting in MarketWatch.com, the U.S. spent 3% of our GDP on roads, bridges, airports, and mass transit. Today, it's 0.3%. Reversing that trend would not only create jobs and boost the economy, but also, as 8 grieving families can attest, it might save lives. I'm the rare conservative who loves Amtrak, said John Fund in thenationalreview.com, and I regularly use its services between Washington and New York City. But trains don't make sense everywhere. To create an American train network we can all be proud of, we have to address the congressional politics that force Amtrak to operate 15 long-distance routes in western states that have few passengers and generate 80% of its losses. Amtrak should close or sell those routes and reallocate resources to trains that people actually use on the East Coast and in California. Let's start using our common sense, rather than either condemning all rail systems as a waste of taxpayer money or blaming budget Scrooges for the death of passengers. Well, it was a good week for appointment television. After an Icelandic public broadcast station aired 24 hours of live sheep birthing, part of its Slow TV campaign, which also featured chess, knitting, and wood burning. It was a good week for little blue wonders after scientists in London found that Viagra may help stop the spread of malaria by making the parasite stiff, making it easier for the spleen to filter the invaders out. It was a good week for full disclosure after a newly released trove of documents from Osama bin Laden's Pakistan lair revealed an application form to join al-Qaeda that asked prospects to list hobbies and provide emergency contacts in case the applicant becomes a martyr. But it was a bad week for high fashion, after several women were stopped from entering theaters and the red carpet at the Cannes Film Festival because they were not wearing high heels. "It's very disappointing," said actress Emily Blunt. "Everyone should wear flats, to be honest." It was a bad week for straight answers, after a group of likely GOP presidential candidates struggled to name the country's greatest living president and defaulted to Ronald Reagan instead. "I'll leave that for the people to decide," said Senator Ted Cruz, who represents Texas, home to the only two Republican options. And it was a bad week for sharing snaps, after Dominique Sharpton, the daughter of controversial civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton, posted pictures on Instagram of her ascent up an Indonesian mountain. Despite her pending $5 million lawsuit against New York City for a chronically sprained ankle injured on a city street. We're on the briefing page now. Alzheimer's time bomb. A looming epidemic of dementia has left scientists racing to find a cure for a disease that destroys minds. How common is Alzheimer's? More than 5.3 million people in the U.S. currently suffer from the debilitating brain disorder, and that number is about to skyrocket. In 2011, the first of the 76 million baby boomers turned 65, the forerunners of a silver tsunami that will double the number of senior citizens by 2050. Alzheimer's predominantly affects the elderly, so scientists predict the number of people afflicted will balloon to as many as 13.8 million in coming decades. With drug companies yet to find a way to cure, prevent, or even delay this highly complex disease, Alzheimer's treatment costs could hit $1.1 trillion and consume as much as 31% of Medicare's budget. Nursing homes will be swamped, and millions of family members who already contribute an estimated 17.9 billion hours a year of unpaid care for loved ones with dementia will be forced to dedicate much of their lives to looking after people who can no longer take care of themselves. "If you don't know anyone who has Alzheimer's," says Dallas Anderson at the National Institute of Aging, you know how dire this projection is for the nation. What causes Alzheimer's? More than a century after Alois Alzheimer discovered the disease, scientists still don't know. Numerous factors have been found to play a role, including lifestyle, diet, genetics, and cardiovascular health, which affects the flow of blood to the brain. What researchers do know, however, is that the disease physically manifests itself in the brain through the abnormal buildup of two proteins. The first, beta amyloid, forms clumps of plaque in and around the neurons. The second, tau, creates tangles that choke the neurons. This neural gunk interferes with communication between brain cells, blocking them from sending messages. Over time, the protein tangles trigger the immune system to attack the brain itself, creating a wildfire of inflammation that destroys neurons and shrinks the brain dramatically. The result is a progressive loss of memory and thinking skills that leaves victims adrift in an all-encompassing mental fog, with pronounced mood swings and inability to recognize loved ones or function in daily life. In its late stages, Alzheimer's can destroy the ability to speak, walk, or even swallow. Are there any treatments? Only 5 Alzheimer's drugs have ever been approved. All of them mildly improve memory loss, but none address the underlying pathology. Several drug companies have identified drugs that fight amyloid formation in the brain and tested them with success on mice, but these compounds have mysteriously failed during human trials, or have even caused people's dementia to worsen. Researchers now believe they've been testing anti-amyloid drugs on patients whose brains are already too damaged to benefit from their effects. Recently, scientists learned that amyloid plaques can start developing in a person's brain a full 15 years before any Alzheimer's symptoms appear, but they had no way of detecting that process when it began. Then in 2012, scientists began using an imaging technique called positron emission tomography, PET, to detect amyloid plaque in a person's brain during the disease's early stages. PET scanners have enabled drug companies to identify and start testing their drugs on early-stage patients who might actually benefit from the anti-amyloids, and the results already look promising. What else is being done? While drug companies hunt for ways to prevent or break down the plaques associated with Alzheimer's, other researchers are trying to determine why these proteins start accumulating in the brains, in the hope of interrupting that process. But since so many factors seem to affect a person's likelihood of developing Alzheimer's, including genetics, diabetes, vascular disease, diet, loneliness, mental activity, and even levels of education, neurologists now think fighting Alzheimer's may be similar to fighting cancer, requiring different medications and treatments for different forms of the disease. We have to get away from the notion that all Alzheimer's patients are the same, said Sid O'Brien, a researcher at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. Is the government helping? Belatedly, yes. In response to the scale of the coming epidemic, the federal government in 2012 unveiled its first ever national plan to address Alzheimer's disease. The plan pours $600 million a year into research, testing, and treatment with the goal of finding a way to prevent or effectively treat the disease by 2025. But this influx of money still leaves Alzheimer's funding lagging way behind that for HIV and cancer, which receive $3 billion and $5.3 billion a year, respectively. Despite the added funding, many Alzheimer's researchers are pessimistic about meeting the government's 2025 goal. Even if a promising anti-amyloid treatment now being developed works in human trials, says neuroscience professor Simon Lovestone, it could still take a full 10 years to bring it to market. And if it doesn't, and researchers have to start from scratch, Lovestone says, we're unlikely to have a new drug in less than 20 years. Real hope for a cure? A new treatment is causing a buzz in the world of dementia research. In March, biotechnology company Biogen unveiled an anti-amyloid called aducanumab, or ADU, the first drug that has substantially reduced the brain plaque associated with Alzheimer's in a human trial. Researchers had noticed a certain kind of antibody in the immune cells of elderly patients who remained mentally sharp. Biogen developed that antibody into ADU, and a lab-created monoclonal antibody. In a test on 166 early-stage sufferers, researchers found that ADU attacked the amyloid plaques in the brain, gradually eliminating the clumps. Within a year, those participants who'd taken ADU performed better in cognitive tests than those who had taken a placebo. Buoyed by the results, Biogen has jumped straight into a final trial involving a much larger group of people, and scientists are crossing their fingers for success. If the treatment's clinical benefit is confirmed, says Alzheimer's researcher Dr. Eric Raymond, it would be a game changer in the scientific fight against Alzheimer's. And we move on to some columns. Two from the U.S. this week. The first comes from Betsy McCaughey at the New York Post, titled "Harvard's Bias Against Asian Students." At Harvard, Asians are the new Jews, said Betsy McCaughey. Though the Ivy League university won't admit to using racial quotas, it limits Asian Americans to 15 to 18% of the student body per year, just as it once limited Jews. How does Harvard keep the racial composition of its student body so consistent? Simple discrimination. Last week, a coalition of 64 Asian American organizations asked the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education to investigate possible racial bias in Harvard admissions. And the evidence they've marshaled is completely convincing. As a group, Asians have the lowest acceptance rate for each SAT test bracket. To gain admission, research has shown they must score 140 points higher than a white student, 270 points higher than a Hispanic student, and 450 points higher than a black student. When California banned universities from taking race into considerations, Asians went from 25% of students at Caltech to 42%. Many superb Asian applicants to Harvard and other top colleges come from working-class immigrant families. Why reject them because their name is Wong or Liu? From James Fallow at TheAtlantic.com, how Fox is damaging the GOP. Fox News has become a serious problem for the Republican Party, said James Fallows. That might be hard to believe, given that Fox is so blatantly biased in favor of the GOP, but a compelling new study by former Reagan administration economist Bruce Bartlett has concluded that Fox is pushing Republicans so far to the right they can't win national elections. The network keeps its ratings high with a steady drumbeat of fear, outrage, and one-sided news reporting and commentary, and has become a dominant factor in shaping the Republican worldview. Two-thirds of Fox viewers say that whites face as much racial discrimination as blacks, and more than half think American Muslims want to establish Sharia law here. To confirm their conservative credentials, Republican candidates echo the network's messaging and sound always outraged themselves. In 2012, Bartlett said, the Fox effect pushed Romney far to the right and kept him from tacking to the center in the general election. Yet inside their Fox bubble of wishful thinking, Republicans were shocked when Romney didn't win. When will the Republicans realize Fox's help is hurting them? This from India, where six-year-olds can work legally. India is backsliding on child labor, said Ricky Norland and Gerard Unk in The Guardian from UK. The government was supposed to pass a law last week that would have outlawed all employment of children under 14, but instead it added a wide array of exceptions that will push millions of children into work rather than education. Under the old law, children ages 6 to 14 were banned from hazardous industries, but could still work in many factories as maids, tea sellers, or laborers on family farms. The new law allows them to work for family enterprises as well as entertainment and sports industries. Labor Minister Bandro Dattatreya insists that children will not be allowed to work only at, insists that children will be allowed to work only after school, and that employment can lift youngsters out of poverty by giving them an entrepreneurial spirit. But there's no evidence that child labor alleviates poverty. In fact, the use of children as workers drives wages down and renders adults jobless because children are easier to exploit. Unfortunately, child labor is too prevalent to be banned outright, said Preetha Thomas in the New Indian Express from India. Children are the pint-sized chihuahuas at railway stations, shoe polishers on pavement, waiters, domestic workers, agricultural laborers. Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself was a chihuahua, a tea seller, as a child. The appalling reality is that many children must help support their families if everyone is to have enough to eat. A blanket ban on child labor will only drive the problem undercover. Better to let children work for their parents legally and ensure that they are still going to school. It's terribly naive to imagine that this law will only result in children picking crops on family farms, said Ursi Basista and Nikita Lamba in Tehekla from India. The family enterprise exception covers any work that a parent does at home. And since many factories have outsourced production to home-based piecework, children can do factory work alongside their parents. That includes carpet weaving, which exposes girls and boys to toxic dyes, or making glass bangles, which coats their lungs with dust and burns them with molten glass. One boy told us he gets up at 4 a.m. to go to school, and after coming home makes bangles until 10 p.m. That is not a childhood. How ironic that just last year we basked in the glory of Kailash Satyarthi winning the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in eradicating child labor, said the Hindustan Times from India in an editorial. Satyarthi has consistently advocated a total ban on work for children under 14, yet his advice is ignored. India has the largest number of child labor laws in the world. Why do we still have the largest number of child workers? Our in-depth article this week is titled, What a Horrible Mother. Leaving a child in the car for a few minutes used to be common, said Kim Brooks. Now, it will get you arrested. In the moments before the police and county prosecutors and child protective services took over her life, Monique was thinking about dinner. Specifically, she wanted a baked chicken. She had just left a birthday party and was driving home with her two daughters. By the time she pulled into the parking lot of a grocery store near her house, her younger daughter, then 4 years old, was taking a much-needed nap. Monique hesitated. She didn't want to wake her daughter to bring her into the store, where she was liable to be as cranky and difficult as anyone else who'd been prematurely awakened. On the other hand, Monique was hungry. "I'll watch her," said the older daughter. She was 8. She had an iPad and she could text her mother from. It was January in Maryland, mild, 45 degrees. A few minutes later, standing in the checkout line of the grocery store, Monique heard her name being paged, asking her to return to her car. When she got there, she found 3 police officers surrounding it, asking if she was the mother of the children in the vehicle, shouting at her, "Do you know how dangerous this is?" The 2 male officers went about the lengthy business of finding an appropriate charge, while the female officer continued to berate Monique, who stood stunned next to the car while her daughters cried. An hour later, they were still there, waiting to be released, when one of the officers asked where Monique's husband was. She told him they were separated. "Well," she said, You need to have him come pick up the kids so we can arrest you. For Dawn, a young mother in New England, it was the same. A moment of convenience followed by one of shock. She had just picked up her daughter from daycare when she remembered she was out of toilet paper. Her daughter, worn out after the day, was strapped into the car seat and busily enjoying what was her first ever Happy Meal. Dawn pulled up in front of a Rite Aid, locked the doors, and sprinted inside. When she returned to the vehicle 3 minutes later, a woman was standing by the window beside Dawn's daughter, who was still waiting comfortably. "You're disgusting," the stranger said. "What a horrible mother. I've called the police on you. I have your license plate number. I'm waiting here to make sure they arrest you." For Courtney, the decision to stop wasn't spontaneous. For days, she'd been meaning to get a gate to put in front of her fireplace to keep her 3-year-old daughter, who'd been growing increasingly curious about it. She was driving home to New York after a weekend visiting her mother-in-law and knew she would be passing a store where she could get just that. 5 minutes before she reached the place, her daughter fell asleep. "She had a little cold," Courtney told me. "I just wanted to let her rest. It was 70 degrees, but I knew I'd only be a couple of minutes." She opened the windows and parked in the shade. She spent no more than 10 minutes in the store. She was on the way back to her car when she noticed something odd. A woman, a stranger, standing near the hood of her car. A store employee on either side of her, all of them staring and watching Courtney as she approached. She experienced a moment of dread. Had something happened to her daughter? But no, her daughter was fine. Courtney opened the back door, adjusted her little girl's blanket. She unlocked the door and got in. And all the while, the woman and employees stood watching her, saying nothing. A few days later, Courtney's husband was stopped by a New York police officer in the lobby of their building. The officer asked his name. If he was Courtney's husband, he said yes. The officer said his wife needed to call the police about an incident in a parking lot. She and the officer spoke for about 30 minutes. The officer asked her to describe what had happened. She could hear the officer typing as she spoke. He asked her to hold on a moment. Then he said, without emotion, "At this point, based on what you've told me, I'd say there's a 90% chance you're going to be arrested." The cases against all three women remain open. Names and some identifying details have been changed. The details, as they have been described to me, are harrowing and strange. Strange enough that 3 years ago I might not have believed them. Back then I was aware that children died after being forgotten or becoming trapped in hot cars. But these were rare and tragic instances that seemed more a matter of horrible forgetfulness than anything criminal. The idea that strangers might be watching for any suggestion of what they deemed to be neglect and prepared to involve the authorities and provide stern, hurtful commentary on top of it seemed absurd, an over-the-top parody mashup of modern parenting techniques and the East German Stasi. Then it happened to me. At the end of a trip home to see my parents, I let my 4-year-old son wait by himself in a car while I ran into a store. He needed headphones to watch a video on our flight home. Someone filmed me leaving him, going into the store, coming out and driving off, and promptly called the police. Ultimately, I was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor, a charge most people associate with buying beer for teenagers. And with the aid of lawyers I was only able to afford through family generosity, arranged to perform 100 hours of community service, and take parenting lessons. In return, the county prosecutor decided not to pursue the matter any further. After I wrote a story about what happened, Monique, Dawn, and Courtney all reached out to me individually through social media, looking for guidance as they navigated the particulars of their cases. The legal aspects, the social services, the staggering personal distress that comes from having a reasonable and informed decision turned into a condemnation of you as a parent by an utter stranger. Their cases fly in the face of logic and statistics on actual dangers. A child is far more likely to be killed or injured in a moving vehicle than in a stationary one. If a child is going to be abducted, far more often the culprit is a family member, not a stranger. Yet parents continue to be harassed and arrested for allowing children to play in a park unsupervised, or walk alone to a friend's house, or wait in the car for a few minutes. What makes this current situation worse is the climate of judgment that seems to have permeated the national consciousness. There is a moral vigilantism about parenting that, as with all forms of vigilantism, veers far into paranoia. A few days after the officer interviewed Courtney by phone, her lawyer informed her that she was being charged with felony child endangerment and that she would need to return to New Jersey to self-report. In a small room, she was electronically fingerprinted and photographed by a police officer. Then she was issued a court date only a few days later, on Labor Day. She knew her lawyer would be unavailable then, told the officer as much, and asked why the date was so soon. That was when Courtney learned she'd been classified as a violent family offender. Courtney's new court date was set on her daughter's first day of preschool. That was one of the hardest parts, she said. Missing her first day of school to go to court and prove I wasn't a neglectful mother. She hired a babysitter, asked a close friend to go with her, and went back across state lines to appear before a judge. The case wasn't heard that day, or the next time she appeared. It dragged on for several months. Ultimately, Courtney was given 1 year of probation with supervision, a year during which she'd need to drive 100 miles each month to meet with an officer. She was surprised at the first meeting when the female officer seemed very eager to dig deep into her case. She asked me what I did for a living, Courtney said, and seemed put off when I told her I was a stay-at-home mom. That was when she got nasty. She asked me how my husband felt about all this, if he was okay with me abandoning our infant in a hot car while he worked to support me. Courtney explained to her that this wasn't what happened, that her daughter was not an infant but 3 years old, and that she had left for a few minutes with the windows open. The officer shook her head, looked Courtney firmly in the eye. I would never do that, she said. Ever. I wish I could say this rush to judgment surprised me. Parents have always seen their children as a form of self-expression. But lately, the parent-child branding has become louder and more incessant. What we let our children do or eat or where they learn or what they watch is often purposefully a comment about what we think of ourselves as much as it is about our children, or rather, what we want others to think of us. The last time I spoke with Courtney, she'd been released from the supervision component of her probation, had succeeded in having her daughter's case closed with Child Protective Services, and seemed to have made peace with both herself and the woman who called the police on her. Still, she feels a more nervous mother than before. Her daughter will refuse to wear her gloves on a cold day, and she feels people are watching and judging her for it. And recently, she grew nervous when her family went to visit a friend for the weekend, and they set up an air mattress for her daughter in the corridor between the bedroom and the walk-in closet. Her daughter loved this and yelled with delight, "I get to sleep in the closet." Courtney felt her whole body tense when she heard her and warned her not to say that at school. "I guess I worry more about what people will think," she told me. And also, she, like me, worries about raising her daughter in a world so often lacking in human decency. And yet there are these rare moments where I feel hopeful, where it seems we haven't entirely forgotten how to interact with other human beings or talk to strangers from a place of openness and curiosity rather than fear. Not long after I first wrote about my experience, I took my daughter back to a branch of the store where my own mess began. When I'd finished shopping, we made our way toward the registers. We'd been waiting a few minutes when I noticed a woman at the front of the next line struggling with her children. She had three of them. She was wearing an infant in a baby sling and pushing the other two in her big red cart when the baby began to cry and the twins began to bicker. The screaming grew louder. The line grew longer. Confronted with the spectacle, I did what everyone else in line was doing. I pretended not to see them. I was about to move into another line when another woman, shopping by herself, stepped up to the mother's cart. I expected the worst. The recording phone, the nasty comment, or piece of unsolicited parenting advice. But instead, the woman without children smiled and asked quite casually if she could help. And then, without waiting for an answer, began unloading the woman's cart, playing peekaboo with the toddler. The mother began to thank her, but she wouldn't hear of it. "Really, it's nothing," she said, and smiled. "You've got your hands full." This was excerpted from a piece that originally appeared in Salon.com. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The Mississippi sharecropper who became king of the blues, and one of my personal favorites. B.B. King, 1925-2015. For generations of fans, B.B. King was the definitive bluesman. With a growling, howling voice that ached with passion and heartbreak, and shimmering, vibrato-laden electric guitar licks, King was a living link between the country blues of the rural South and the urban blues of the North. His signature style, a sung verse followed by an extended guitar solo, was born from King's own musical shortcomings. Unable to sing and play simultaneously, he developed a call and response between himself and his Gibson electric guitar, which he named Lucille. "Lucille is real," said King. "I'd be playing sometimes, and as I'd play, it seems like it almost has a conversation with her. It tells you something. It communicates with me." Born Riley King to a family of sharecroppers near the small town of Itabena, Mississippi, the musician had a childhood that could have been pulled straight from a harrowing blues song. "His parents split up when he was 4, and his mother died when he was 9, said the Washington Post. King ran away from his father's home and settled in Indianola, Mississippi, earning a living picking cotton for a penny a pound. A minister taught the teenager King guitar, and he supplemented his income by playing on the street corners for change. He soon realized that when he played gospel songs, listeners would be polite and encouraging, but rarely put any money into his hat. But people that would ask me to sing a blues song would always tip me and maybe give me a beer," he recalled. "Sometimes I'd make $50 or $60 one Saturday afternoon. Now you know why I'm a blues singer." After a brief stint in the Army during World War II, King moved to Memphis and started performing in nightclubs. "He was a hit," said the New York Times, and in the late 1940s was hired to work as a DJ at a local blues station under the nickname Beale Street Blues Boy. King, who had never owned a record player, was suddenly able to immerse himself in music from the jump blues of Louis Jordan to the electric style of T-Bone Walker. "I was the kid in the candy store," said King, "able to eat it all." In 1951, when he recorded his first hit single, 3 O'Clock Blues, the Beale Street Blues Boy was known simply as BB. By the end of the decade, he was playing upwards of 275 one-night stands a year, including a legendary run of 342 gigs in 1956. By the mid-1960s, young black audiences were increasingly defecting to soul music, and the blues, with its unwelcome reminders of segregation and rural poverty, was in decline, said the Times. King was also in financial difficulty, thanks to a chronic gambling addiction and the theft of his copyrights by unscrupulous record producers. Salvation came from British invasion acts like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton, who grew up listening to his records. King opened for the Stones in 1969, the same year that he released his biggest hit, The Thrill Is Gone, and began playing folk festivals and rock concerts and appearing on The Tonight Show. The musician became known as the preeminent blues ambassador, said the USA Today. He appeared on albums alongside Clapton, Stevie Wonder, and U2, performed for presidents and Pope John Paul II, and opened a chain of blues clubs across the U.S. But despite all his success, King remained humble. "Each night I do a concert or do a show, it's like an audition. 'Cause I remember the days when it was," King said in 2005. "I still have that mentality that if these people didn't like me, what would I be doing? Probably plowing." On the health and science page, bracing for a stronger El Nino. El Nino, the ocean warming phenomenon responsible for devastating droughts, forest fires, and floods, is back. And climatologists are warning that its impact might be more severe than ever. First observed by Peruvian fishermen in the 1600s, El Nino occurs when water in the southern Pacific Ocean becomes unusually warm due to weakened trade winds. Typically lasting 9 to 12 months, the warming in turn triggers extreme weather patterns around the world. There have been 26 El Nino events since 1900, and more than half of them have resulted in widespread drought in Australia, India, Indonesia, and parts of Southeast Asia, leading to increased wildfires, reduced crop production, and higher food prices in areas heavily dependent on agriculture. South American and Eastern Pacific nations are hit with heavy rainfall, floods, and landslides. The U.S. Gulf Coast sees increased precipitation, and the Pacific Northwest grapples with drought-like conditions. El Nino typically occurs every 3 to 5 years, but scientists caution that global warming may increase the frequency and intensity of the phenomenon. "There's always a little bit of doubt when it comes to intensity forecasts," David Jones of Australia's Bureau of Meteorologists tells Agence France-Presse. "But across the models as a whole, we'd suggest that this will be quite a substantial El Nino event." On the Talking Points page, religion. Is Christianity fading in the U.S.? "The future of Christianity in America looks very bleak," said Rod Dreher in AmericanConservative.com. "A Pew Research Center survey reveals that over the past 7 years, the number of Americans who self-identify as Christian has dropped nearly 8 points to about 70%. While the number of citizens who claim no religious affiliation has hit an all-time high of 23%. And among these nones, fully 31% consider themselves either atheist or agnostic. The collapse is apparent across all age groups and ethnicities, but it is most pronounced among millennials. Clearly, we are staring in the face of a European-style collapse in religious observance within a couple of generations. Hallelujah, said David Usborne in independent.co.uk. The effect organized religion has had on American politics has been utterly toxic. The Christian right has tried for decades to impose its harsh Old Testament views on the entire country, launching angry battles against women's reproductive rights and gay marriage. Rather than ignoring these fringe voices of intolerance, Republicans pander to them. This is a principal reason Americans are turning away in droves, said Todd Robertson in the Dallas Morning News. In a modern world torn apart by medieval religious extremism, who wants to be affiliated with intolerance? The survey actually reveals something more complex than a slow and steady march towards secularization, said Emma Green in TheAtlantic.com. Among those who claimed no religious affiliation, 44% said religion is very or somewhat important to them. That's not the pattern of a godless nation. It's the pattern of a people finding God on their own terms. Americans have a long history of custom tailoring their religious identities, said Peter Mansou in nytimes.com. In the Great Awakening of the 18th century, many people replaced stuffy old faiths with hugely popular open-air revivals that eventually gave rise to many of the same denominations that appear to be losing numbers to the nuns today. America is the land of reinvention, and the next revival may be led by people who explore Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, and various New Age disciplines. That is, by those with too many spiritual influences to choose just one. After all, thou shalt remain open to new ideas might as well be the first commandment of our national faith. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.